Welcome to a special webinar featuring commentary from Envestnet PMC on the current markets. Speaking today are Zachary Karabel, Head of Global Strategy at Envestnet, Brandon Thomas, Chief Investment Officer at Envestnet PMC, and Tim Clift, Chief Investment Strategist at Envestnet PMC. For your reference, all lines have been placed into a listen-only mode to prevent background noise. If you would like to submit a question for our speakers, please type it into the Q&A console located on your GoToWebinar screen. We will attempt to answer as many of your questions as possible during the call. If you have any technical difficulties, please email madeline.smith@investnet.com for assistance. We will be recording today's event and expect to make it available directly after the session. I will now turn it over to Zachary to begin the session.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Obviously, it's been an incredibly tumultuous 4 days in equity market land, and we thought it might be good to get together, share some of our perspective on what's going on in the market, and also some thoughts about what one does at a portfolio level and at a technical level with these kind of market moves. So I'm going to give a 10-minute overview of what we feel is going on in market land and what this likely means. And then Tim Clift will talk more. Well, I guess Brandon Thomas will first go into some of what's going on in the markets at a more granular level. And then Tim Clift will talk a bit about what this portends for portfolio and portfolio management and balancing. So first on the markets, you know, it's been the kind of 2 days that, depending on what hour of the past 2 days you were talking, your sensibility about what was going on in the markets could have been radically different. You know, if you had decided over the weekend that there was a client who hadn't been exposed to equities at all and that finally they were going to take the equity plunge and had begun that at Monday morning at 9:30, they actually would be up 4 or 5% given even what today's sell-off in the last 20 minutes of the market. The market had been down, you know, 1,100 points on the Dow and 7 or 8% on the NASDAQ before 10 o'clock on Monday morning. And today, the market's underwent this just massive 700-800 point swing yet again, except this time it went from positive to negative instead of yesterday, where it went from negative to a little less negative to sort of majorly negative. And I think the question we all have is, okay, what is this? There's a lot out there that is weaving together a narrative that I think we do need to take seriously, that this market movement was A, long overdue, one, because the market hadn't had a correction in several years, two, because every other asset class from currencies to fixed income to high yield to commodity prices had been undergoing much more volatility in the past 6 to 12 months, and only equities, particularly U.S. equities, had been largely immune from that volatility. Three, because of potential central bank tightening in the United States and maybe an end of some of the easy money policies. And four, most prominently and most precipitously, some sense that the China economic story, after years of speculation about whether China was going to have a hard landing or a soft landing, and China had essentially had no landing, that finally the Chinese government was at the end of their ability to manage or provide liquidity to paper over some of the systemic issues, and that the kind of implosion of China's equity markets over the past 3 to 4 weeks was a signal of deep economic problems in China, and that in turn, along with the concomitant collapse in global commodity prices and oil prices, some of which, of course, are tied to China demand, created this perfect storm recipe, you call it what you will, for a significant market decline. And that narrative has had a lot of repetition in the media and a lot of reinforcement, but I'm not entirely clear that that is the full story or that it's really the story that should be carrying us forward. And just full disclosure in all this, right, I'm presenting a market view, and I think between Tim, Brandon, and all of PMC, we have some ideas about what we think about the market. It is also equally true that at an investment PMC level, and I'm sure Tim will talk about this a bit when he talks about portfolio diversification, we are quite committed to providing a series of both research and investment tools and portfolios that allow for different points of view to be invested in, so that I may be more skeptical and we may be more skeptical that this portends a significant bear market, but we certainly do research on and construct portfolios that allow for advisors and clients to invest much more defensively if you believe that in fact this is an extremely risky time and that significant defensive posturing is needed. That being said, I don't believe that there are yet the ingredients in the global economic system that come together in such a way to spell a protracted period of either bear market in equities or really fundamental disruptions that lie ahead. The factors that I just discussed that have been talked about a lot, slowing in China or the shift of China's economy, the fact that China had been in a Shanghai equity bubble that popped, but you know, whether that is really a reflection of the actual real world economy is another issue. And certainly some questions about interest rates. You know, these have all been part of the mix for many, 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 many months, if not longer than that. And it's not as though something triggered this four-day period, other than it's August, there was an intense amount of price action coming out of Asia, and there was, until Thursday or Friday, a lot of programmatic trading. So some estimates have put the amount of trading until Monday, at least, that has been triggered by computer algorithms rather than individuals or institutions at upwards of 50% of all market volume. Now, I don't know whether that is entirely true today, although when there are feeding and selling frenzies in the market, that is actually enhanced by algorithmic and computer trading. And these things can develop momentum because of it. I don't know how many individuals are actually going and liquidating portfolios or going to cash, or how many institutions are for that matter. And unless you believe that the market in this case is in fact acting as a cliche canary in the coal mine or a lightning rod, then you have to go back to, are there adequate signals in the global system that we are on the verge of either a global recession, a China collapse? I think it would be very difficult for China to collapse without dragging global growth down substantially. I mean, how much it would drive the U.S. down or not is unclear, but it is, I think, pretty clear that we would not survive a real China economic downturn unscathed. You know, whether that's Nike's sales in China and then earnings, or Apple's, or our own exports to China, which are considerable and growing even more. So if you, unless that's really what's going on, and there's a lot of countervailing evidence to the contrary about Western Europe, you know, it's not great in terms of unemployment rates, but there's certainly decent economic growth at 1%-ish, and that's in a relatively stagnant demographic. The United States continuing to sort of chug along unimpressively but uninterruptedly. Japan, you know, is a mixed bag. Some of their export economy is very closely tethered to China demand, so it is sensitive to China. And the fact that the Chinese consumer middle class seems to be expanding substantially, and to some degree, one of the questions out there for the months ahead is going to be, are the economics of China's growth and what economists perceive or policymakers perceive of significant weakness, is that really the most dominant story of China, or is it what the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, sees in China? And he actually took a rather unprecedented step for Apple and came out yesterday and said that they are seeing ever stronger sales into the Chinese middle class consumer market. And remember, iPhones and iPods and iPads are an even higher end purchase relative to China's income than they are in the United States, but they're seeing millions and millions of these being sold on a quarterly basis. You know, you have to ask, that's coming from somewhere, right? That's real world economic activity. So unless you think that in fact we are in a, you know, the final iteration of, this has been a long time coming, central bank liquidity, it's all drying up, and therefore we're going to really contract, you are left with a market phenomenon, which is in no way, as I think anybody who's been doing this for a while knows, in no way unprecedented. We have a chart here about market corrections. You know, there have been very few of them over the past 4 years, but there have been a lot of them over time. Patricia, I don't know, is there a slide after this that we can go to after, you know, so, you know, 1998, 1999 obviously felt very sharp at the time with the Asian crisis, but that was in the midst of an incredibly robust bull market. It wasn't the end of one. I don't know that one would characterize the past years in the equity market as an incredible bull run. I mean, it was incredible if you had invested everything starting in March of 2009. But if you've been invested in these markets for any time longer than that, these have been still very up and down markets that over a 10-year period are much more sideways than they are up. So we're not talking about kind of, at least in my view, a bull market that really is old in the teeth the way is often invoked. And while you may not have the recipe for massive expansion of corporate profits, companies in the second quarter actually did somewhat better than expected. If you took out the negative of energy companies in the second quarter, the S&P generated both low single-digit revenue gains and high single-digit earnings gains, which is considerably better than most people expected and is genuine expansion. And again, that was only brought down a bit by energy companies contracting about 6% because of lower oil prices. And even lower oil prices, which is pointed to as potentially a sign for slowing economic activity, given that the mix of energy consumption has shifted to renewables and higher efficient use of oil, I don't think you can make the same assumption about oil consumption being a proxy for economic activity that you might have been able to make 5 or 10 years ago. So it's not as if the global economic situation changed so dramatically in the past 4 days. You know, one joke about that is Netflix has been down 20% because it was such a momentum stock. I don't think far fewer people decided to watch Orange is the New Black or House of Cards on Tuesday today versus Wednesday of last week. So that movement of the stock is much more of a price action and momentum than it is an indication of deteriorating fundamentals. And as we know, many stocks have sold off not just a 10% correction, but a lot of stocks are 20-plus percent below their 52-week highs. I don't know if today's reversal suggest that we have somewhat more downside ahead. That could entirely be the case. But as Wilbur Ross talked about earlier in the day, it's difficult to see the economic fundamentals having deteriorated so massively. Again, to just reiterate, there is an argument out there for those fundamentals have been in a steady state of deterioration, and we've been able to avoid the consequences of that. But I think that's probably a less likely scenario. We do provide investment strategies if you believe that to be the scenario. But until it's much more evident that this market is signaling something, and I don't think equity markets, particularly when they move this quickly with such volatility, are perfect signalers. You know, the old Paul Samuelson joke of stock markets have predicted 9 out of the past 5 recessions, I think remains a wonderful way of highlighting the degree to which there are times that markets are leading indicators of overall activity, but markets often have their own internal dynamics, which are not always easy to discern. And when you have this kind of trading volatility and this kind of programmatically driven trading volatility, it is probably wise, if you had been creating a thoughtful investment platform before, to think about taking some advantage of these weaknesses, perhaps buying things that have suddenly become 20% more attractive, and at the very least to think about putting money to work, not necessarily in the midst of this, but in spite of this. So I think we're going to know soon enough, whether it's tomorrow or the next 2 to 3 days, kind of where this all plays out. And again, we're not here prognosticating about whether today's reversal leads to further downside tomorrow. It certainly is not a positive sign, but I'm not sure it's any more or less negative than what happened yesterday or on Friday. And these things have happened in much more severe fashion in both the distant and more recent past. And it is important to figure out or to assess whether or not this time is different. But it's also, I think, important to remind ourselves that these are hardly odd moments, and to try to talk to our clients about past moments and how quickly these things can blow over like squalls and reverse, and how rarely they are, in fact, a harbinger of a complete meltdown. So I think with that, I don't know if there are any more slides you want to just quickly scroll through, Patricia, that I had. I think those are the ones. And I think with that, we can turn it over to Brandon Thomas.
Thanks, Zachary, and good afternoon, everybody. I think what we'll do is pivot to more of a technical and quantitative look at what's happened in the markets here relative to historical standards and some of the periods we've seen in the past. And certainly, obviously, over the last several trading days, there have been several indicators that have demonstrated how extreme and even climactic the selling became yesterday and how volatile it has been today. And one example of that, as you can see, is the VIX index, which spiked to its highest level in more than 23 years yesterday, if you take out the 2008-2009 period. So it reached an extreme yesterday that we haven't seen almost since the inception of the index, except for that one period. So that's one indication of just how volatile and unstable the market was yesterday, driven by a lot of this algorithmic trading that Zachary mentioned. On the next slide is another indicator, which is relative strength of the S&P 500. And you can see that just yesterday, the 9-day relative strength, RSI, of the S&P 500 plunged down to one of the lowest levels we've seen in the past 10 years, the lowest level since 2011, and then one of the lowest levels in the past 10 years. So internal strength in the market, volatility in the market have been two indicators. And you can see also, I just wanted to point out the divergence there, those dotted lines, those slanted dotted lines that have been drawn on the graph there. You can see the downward sloping line of the relative strength, meaning, and the upward sloping line on the S&P 500, the price index. And you can see that the market was rising even though the internal strength of the index has been declining. So these types of situations, these divergences aren't uncommon, and they typically play out in the way we've seen today, although not quite to the extent that we've seen over the last couple of days. And then one other indicator that we see on the next slide is the put-call ratio on the CBOE. And this, the bottom panel there just indicates what the ratio of volume and puts to calls has been over the last 10 years. And you can see again that that yesterday's activity really represented an extreme level that really we haven't seen since 2009 and the early late 2009 and then back in 2006. And the put-call ratio, of course, is a sort of a sentiment indicator. Where people who are negative and thinking the market's going down will obviously buy more puts than they do calls. And so that a rise in that indicator shows that the ratio is increasing very rapidly. And it's often used as a contrarian indicator. And so because sentiment generally can't get much worse than it is at those extreme peaks. So those three are just some of the indicators that that have shown just how climactic yesterday's action was, and even leading into today. And so what does that really mean? Does that you know, we've got these indicators that are you know, flashing a signal that we've seen some extreme activity, and does that mean equities have the all clear sign and the next move is higher? And on the next few slides, what we'll do is talk about some of the historical information and market action that we've seen in periods like this. One of the things that might give us a little bit of caution at this point in time is just the seasonality of the market and where we are in the season. Right now, we're in the midst of one of the seasonally weakest times of the year. Late August through early October has historically been the softest part of the year for equities. And you can see that in this graph, which is this chart, this bar chart that shows the average monthly return on the S&P 500 going back to 1950. And you can see that August and September are the two weakest months, and September really is the only month of the year that hasn't generated a positive return on average since 1950. So generally speaking, this is, and you know, most of the big market declines that we've seen, the big ones, 1929, 1987, even last year at this time, we saw the decline. And so this time of year, whatever the reason, there are a lot of theories for it, but whatever the reason, this time of year tends to bring out more pessimism and skepticism about the economy and so forth, and that drives stock prices lower. And so so we've seen a downturn now, and so we're heading into the headwinds here, this seasonally weak period, so that might give us a little bit of caution here, even if we may have seen the bottom, but it may not have the strength of being a strong indicator that stocks are going to shoot right up again. On the next slide, we can see that that another reason that patience will be a virtue when it comes to giving the buy signal for stocks is that we rarely see a V-shaped bottom coming out of a steep market decline like we've seen. Historically, in most declines like the one we've just been through, there's a short-term bottom established, followed by a bounce higher, and then the market retests the initial low, sometimes falling below it, before it then begins to work its way higher. Some analysts have pointed to the environment in 2011, in which the Eurozone was in serious trouble, as having market action very similar to the present. And that's, you can see that slanted line there in the middle in 2011, that's that period of time. At that time, the market made an initial low on August 8th, then rallied and sold off again before bottoming out on October 3rd. Something similar happened during the market decline in 2008 and 2009. And the point really is that there's rarely a time where you see the type of volatility, the decline we saw yesterday and the volatility we saw yesterday, and then the market reverse course immediately and start higher. It just rarely happens. On the next slide, too, we can see further indication of that in the past over a couple of different periods that were well known. 1987, obviously, during that period of time in October where the market fell, I think it was 22% on Black Monday, bounced up. There was a lot of volatility those next few days, and then it stabilized a little bit and then traded lower back down and tested those lows again before it started off higher again. Same thing in 1998 during the summer. I think it was August through September. During the Asian financial crisis, where the market again dropped down, rallied higher, tested the lows, and then took off again. So in summary, from a technical perspective, the market exhibited some extreme selling, climactic selling on Monday, the type that often indicates that a short-term bottom has been established. However, using history and seasonality as a guide, it seems likely that the coming weeks will be volatile and that we could retest the lows 1867, I think, on the S&P yesterday, and it would not be surprising there was a low of 1820 on the S&P going back to last October, and that's been the recent low on the S&P, and it would not be surprising if we went through 1867 and tested that 1820 low before heading higher again. It's worth pointing out, though, that 2016, next year, obviously, is a presidential election year, and since 1932, the S&P has risen 81% of the time for an average gain of over 9% in those years. And so from a technical standpoint, from a seasonality and history standpoint, next year leans positively, but obviously there's a lot that goes into that with, as Zachary talked about, the global economy, the currency situation, what the Fed does with interest rates, and that's just a technical backdrop, and I guess the summary would be that even though we've seen this sharp decline, and even though a bottom may be in place in the short term, it wouldn't be out of the question for the market to trade a little bit higher in volatile trading, trade back lower, test the lows, maybe even a little bit lower before it moves higher again. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tim for a discussion of diversification in portfolios and how to think about that going forward.
Great, thanks, Brandon. And I guess I do want to switch gears a little bit here to what clients are probably actually experiencing, right? So we're hearing a lot about the S&P and the Dow, and you know the charts that we're showing are kind of focused in that area, but it is a narrow part of the market that's just focused on large cap U.S. equity. And I would say few, if any, clients are invested exclusively in the S&P 500 or just in large cap equity. So it really is important to put some context around how the rest of the markets have performed and the benefits of diversification. And you know, I know we go back and then sometimes diversification seems to really help in portfolios and other times it doesn't. So just outlined here just a couple of time periods. So last year is one year where there was a lot of knocks against diversification in that, you know, clients would see the headline news and it looked like the markets were all up 10% when in fact they weren't. Global markets were actually down last year and most other categories were up, you know, modest single digits. So a diversified portfolio, you know, was more likely up just, you know, 3 or 4% versus up double digits. So last year it didn't look like diversification worked, but it actually did. You know, it just wasn't concentrated in large cap equity. And that's actually a good thing. So if you then look at the first half of this year, in what categories perform well, and what we've done here on this little table is highlighted the best three performing categories. So in 2014, it was who the market leaders were. So in 2014, it was exclusively large cap that had the best performance. In the first half of this year, it switched. So now it switched to small cap and it switched to international markets. Those were by far the best performing asset classes. And then when you go to the third quarter, the leadership changed again. So we've switched over to basically fixed income and hedge fund absolute return type of products. So out of the nine categories here, each time period we looked at last year versus the first half of this year versus this most recent period, and this was up through yesterday, the leaders changed constantly. And so anybody out there thinking that they can time that just right and be all in large cap in 2014 and then move to small cap international in the first half of this year and then switch to fixed income and alternatives most recently, yeah, that's a very, very difficult, if not impossible, trade to happen. And that just goes to show why diversification does make sense, because the leaders and the laggards change very frequently, and having exposure to these different asset classes will reduce volatility in clients' portfolios. It'll get them exposure to asset classes that are performing well, and they can also help offset those that aren't performing well. So, you know, kind of across the board, the message is very clear. And looking at these time periods, I think is helpful. Interestingly enough, one of the asset classes that has gotten a lot of pushback is the alternatives area, the hedge fund area. And you can see here, it's, well, not providing big gains, it's been positive. And it was actually this quarter so far has remained positive. It's done what it's supposed to when the markets get volatile. And that's why in a lot of PMC portfolios, we do position the portfolios with some alternatives in there. And well, in 2014, they would have been a lag from a return standpoint versus those large cap categories. It sure felt good to have that exposure in portfolios in the third quarter when the markets have been going down for the most part. So that's just looking over the short term. The next slide gives you a broader perspective, but a very similar story. And a lot of you know the details of this chart aren't as important as kind of the general context, which is that the different asset classes, and all this does is represent all this, a whole lot of different asset classes in which ones perform better or worse, and they're ranked, you know, highest to lowest. And you can see in this table that the leaders and the laggards change on every single year. One of the kind of highlighted in yellow is commodities. That one is kind of bounced from best to worst very frequently. It's very, tends to be very volatile. It's typically why you don't have a whole lot of exposure in client portfolios to commodities, but it also can provide a lot of excess return in those time periods where it's positive. But I think the more important area that's highlighted is that kind of blue line, and that's the diversified balance type of portfolio, a 60-40 allocation that's globally diversified with large cap and small cap and basically all these different categories mixed together. And you can see that it's never been the best performer, but it's also never been the worst performer. That's really what we're looking for in portfolio management, is to smooth out those returns to have much better risk-adjusted returns over time when we're building portfolios, and that's what clients are looking for. They don't want the extremes in volatility, and they're willing to give up some of that upside to reduce their downside exposure, particularly when we get into markets like we have currently. The other point I wanted to make here on the next slide is just around rebalancing. So the golden rule here is, you know, to buy on fear and sell on euphoria. That's always a challenge to do. To see folks jumping into the market on days like yesterday when it's hard to tell if that's a market bottom or a beginning of worse things to come. But a portfolio that's being rebalanced, and typically we do a lot of rebalancing on an annual basis for clients, selling those that are winners and buying into those that are either undervalued or ones that have underperformed more recently tends to give us a better risk-adjusted return and better returns over the long term. And there's lots of studies and statistics that go to show the difference between a rebalanced portfolio and an unrebalanced one. We've got some statistics here. And again, you may give up a little bit on the upside, but you also are protecting quite a bit more on the downside by doing that rebalancing. So, again, that's something that we do at PNC in portfolios. We do it both at the individual level for clients when their individual portfolio falls out of a risk tolerance level that we need it to be at, but we also do it just on an annual basis to make sure that all those asset classes are in the allocations that we really intended them to be, because you can have one asset class that runs and does very well, but it may be a risky asset class, and you don't want to have that overexposure when the markets eventually correct, which they always do. You know, we've gotten a technical correction here in the third quarter. Whether this is the end of it and folks are starting to feel better and we're seeing buying like today, or whether there's still some more downside, again, the idea of both full diversification in portfolios and this rebalancing are ways to mitigate losses in portfolios, have better risk-adjusted returns in portfolios, and it's good just to remind clients that that's why we do it. This is the ideal time to kind of refocus on why diversification makes sense and not to just focus on the few asset classes that may be outperforming at one time. And, you know, why don't I hold those, or why aren't I concentrated in those asset classes? So those are the comments I wanted to make around diversification and portfolio management. I think with that, we're going to open it up to some questions here. So I'm going to turn it back over to our operator to see if we've got any questions lined up.
Looks like we have one question. And Brandon, you may have touched on this earlier, but the question is, on the VIX and volatility, when you see the VIX close today at 37.79 and the next VIX futures contract close at around 25, is that a sign of more severe volatility coming our way? For example, insurance is less expensive in the future than in the present.
Generally speaking, when you see the forward contracts trading lower, it typically means that the market anticipates that volatility will ease going forward. So the spot volatility, as you indicated, has been higher recently, and the forward volatility through the futures is lower, and that generally means that traders are more sanguine about volatility. They're more confident that volatility is coming down. Along with that, what I should point out too is that we've seen sort of another argument that the market really is kind of doing something that may not have been, may not sync up with what some of the underlying fundamentals point out, is that we've seen interest rates hold steady here. Usually when you see these types of shocks to the equity market, you see the treasury yields come way down. And we haven't seen that, honestly. They've come down a little bit, but not very much. So both the 2-year and the 10-year yields they've remained very stable. And in fact, the 10-year yield today was up 6 basis points, about 207, and the 2-year still, it was up 3 basis points to about 160. So that's another indication, I think, that traders think, along with volatility, that traders think that that things will probably stabilize. And in fact, it seems like some, there's some, traders out there that think the Fed, despite what's happened, the Fed may still, be leaning toward raising rates this year. So I just thought that was a very interesting piece of data that that's been playing out over the last week or so.
Great. We have one more question. I think this is for Tim. Regarding rebalancing, is it a good time to rebalance now, or do you simply mean that rebalancing is important in general?
I think it's because the asset classes have shifted so quickly, it's hard to rebalance on a specific market dip or, as we saw yesterday. I think if you had a client that was looking to enter the markets, it might have been, this type of period when markets are down, that can be a good time to either dollar cost average in or slowly move into the markets. What's important to look at is what your client's asset allocation recommendation is and where they are given that. So the market shouldn't necessarily determine when you rebalance. It really should be when the client deviates from that allocation significantly. So we typically have a band of about 15% around our different asset allocations, and when it moves outside that range, basically 7% up or 7% down from the broad allocation, that would be an opportune time to rebalance. If a client has any significant categories where they've, had a big run-up, that's also a good time to rebalance and bring those back into their recommended allocations. You just don't want to deviate too far because that can change the risk dynamics of the portfolio. So that's what we're looking for, not necessarily trying to, time when these big shifts in the market happen. It really need to look at the individual client and where they've deviated or not deviated from their recommended allocation.
We have a couple more questions that came in. What part is the retail investor playing in current trading volume? I'm not sure who wants to take that one.
I mean, maybe Brandon and I can address. Look, it's very difficult to know in real time exactly what percentage is, because unless Schwab et al. Are releasing their trading. So all we know is that by some market estimates, I know last week, Brandon, you may have seen some further details on this, something like 50% was programmatic or algorithm. I don't know what it was today. It by all anecdotals from the trading desk, a rather small portion of this is being retail driven, but I'm not sure there's more exact numbers than that.
Yeah, I agree, Zachary. It's, you know, obviously today the environment's a lot different than it was, you know, 5-10 years ago. And a lot of these high-frequency traders, these algorithmic traders, are driving the volume in the market. And so I would suspect, I honestly don't know the percentage, but I would suspect that it's the retail participation has been very, very small.
Which is, by the way, just when you read all the stories about China's equity markets, almost all of that is retail. A huge portion of that's retail, which is one of the reasons why it can be so vertiginously up and then down. There's not nearly as much programmatic trading there as there is on U.S. and European exchanges.
I think we have time for one more question. The U.S. economy is fine, but how important is the Chinese long-term on our long-term economy?
So I think the health of China and the health of the U.S. economy are probably the two single largest and most significant determinants of whether or not the global system will continue to expand. The only caveat to that is that GDP numbers alone don't necessarily tell you the full picture of how that's going to be important. So China's GDP was growing at 8 or 9% years ago because of a combination of exports to developed world economies and huge multi-billion or tens or hundreds of billions of dollars of state spending on infrastructure, high-speed rail, new apartment blocks. The state spending in particular is not a sustainable basis of economic growth. So while the numbers were very gaudy, that's not exactly the basis of long-term stability. If China's GDP slows, but increasingly large percentages of that are a product of internal domestic China's activity as well as consumption, and I don't mean consumption of industrial raw materials, but consumption of middle-class goods and food and, you know, other stuff, then that's a much more sustainable, and given that if it continues to spread to ever larger percentages of China's 1.4 or 5 billion people, that becomes a very powerful global growth engine, in many ways potentially more powerful than simply China's state spending on infrastructure. Even though that headline number might look less large, it will still be, in some sense, a higher quality, more sustainable, and potentially more impactful rate of growth. So the real question is, does China make that transition, and how long does it take, and how smooth is it? Clearly, it's not going to be as smooth as some ideal version of it would have, although it has yet to be incredibly bumpy. I mean, this does not count yet as incredibly bumpy. And I think that is the most important question of the next 5 to 10 years for the global economic system. China has managed much more economic growth at a much higher quality for the past 20 plus years than anyone would have thought possible, and probably than any country has ever achieved. So I think while the past is prelude but not indicative, you have to take that very seriously as a sign of what might lie ahead. And while there are a lot of naysayers out there, there's also a lot of evidence that China is muddling through this transition about as well as could be expected. And whether it does so will have pretty potent ramifications. It's true the United States is somewhat inoculated from that, and that we have a very powerful internal market, and that will continue to be the case. But we will certainly thrive more if China thrives than we will thrive if China flails.
Great. Looks like we're out of time for today. Thank you, Zachary, Brandon, and Tim, and thank you all for attending. We hope you found it beneficial. If you have any further questions, please contact your InvestNet Regional Advisory Services team. Thank you, everyone, and have a great day.